And we're live. Hello and a very warm welcome to Not the 92 Extra with me, Gregory Clark. As always, I am your host and I'm joined as ever by Tom Mitchell. I hope you're all keeping well. Before we introduce our special guest tonight, a big shout out to our sponsors, Farrelly Sports. Farrelly Sports was established in 2018 with a vision to reinvent the relationship between club and the supplier. They aim to bring a high-end, fashionable approach into designing and crafting football kits. Farrelly Sport provide a professional and premium service at an attainable price point and boast several partner clubs in their portfolio. Anyway, we're joined by a very special guest tonight, and one I'm left with no doubt you're all excited to listen to. It's an absolute pleasure to welcome him onto the show. Ladies and gentlemen, it's Maurice Ross. Maurice, thanks for joining us. How are you?
I'm fine. I've had a kind of boring day today. I've been at B&Q, I've got a new lawnmower. I've made the dinner. It's, you know what it's like when you're out of work. You're trying to fill yourself with half an hour spots, hour slots to, you know, getting my steps in on the Fitbit. Not quite the same as coaching. But I'm enjoying the wee break and I kind of focus and kind of emphasise the wee. I don't plan on making a habit of being out of work. So I'm just waiting on the right opportunity to pop up. And I'm fairly confident it will.
Well, that's the reason behind this conversation. This is a conversation predominantly centred on your coaching career and journey, Maurice. Rolling it right back to the very seeds of your career, what first inspired you to be a coach?
When I quit at 31, which is quite young, my body was packing in and I was getting injured all the time. And I knew it was coming because my game was all about physicality and being dynamic, and when my body was packing in, you know yourself, the signs are there. And so I kind of forced myself to fall out of love with football. That was my defence mechanism. So when I quit, I started studying engineering online at the Open University, and then I moved to Norway with my partner at the time. And after 6 months, I went to see a fourth division game, which was local to me. And I spoke to their CEO, and then that was it. I agreed pretty quickly after that. They got relegated. No, they got relegated from the third to the fourth, and I took over in the fourth, where they had four players signed. They had no budget for players. It was basically you were giving them an environment to play football in. And but what they did have, they had phenomenal facilities. They had a floodlit arena, a full-time groundsman. They had eight changing rooms, pavilion. They had a dining area, they had two AstroTurfs and another grass pitch. So I had two floodlit arenas. We were great at everything that was for free. And, you know, it taught me a lot about the skill set you need to cajole people to try and bring them on and have structure without, you know, that whole fear thing that happens in football where if you don't turn up on time, you're going to get fined. If you don't wear the right socks, you're getting fined. And I believe the years I spent in Scandinavia, I feel like I've honed these interpersonal skills, whereas, you know, I come from a background where it was, you know, it was do what you're told, you know, that kind of, it doesn't work anymore. And I think when you're in Scandinavia, it's a socialist state, so there's no real hierarchy in Norway, so that carrot and the stick doesn't work. So I believe I honed a lot of the soft skills. I'm still working on them. I still think I have that natural thing to sometimes have a wee bite, as we all do in the football world, but I definitely feel that, tactics aside, that whole part of me growing as an individual, learning other cultures, was very helpful for me, to be honest.
This is amazing, Mo, because it's quite unconventional to, well, first of all, finish playing at 31 in Scotland, but then beyond that, you're planning, your succession planning constantly. You moved into the oil and gas industry. Now, because it's unconventional, I think the listeners would love to know a bit more about it. What was the propellant behind that decision to move into that industry?
I always enjoyed the mathematical side of my education at school. I wasn't much into music or language or anything like that. I enjoyed physics, I enjoyed mathematics, enjoyed chemistry. And it was by chance, I just thought, you know what, engineering is such a broad stroke. You can go into so many different fields. And I thought, you know what, I fancy that. And I think it's something that my mind could take up again. So I looked into it. And the first year was basically learning calculus again and all the differentiation. And I just really loved it. And when I quit, I must admit, and again, it's all the rage now. When I say all the rage, people talk about it all the time now, that the whole mental health issue. I started having these thoughts that were a wee bit cloudy for me. And my mother has a history of, you know, being depressed. So she can see the signs in me. And she says, look, let's go to the doctor and have a chat with him. I went to the doctor and he said, look, I can't prescribe you anything for another couple of weeks. Come back. I said, Mom, I'm going there. So I just said, I need routine in my life. I need something to focus my mind on. And I set basically a curriculum for the year, where I would go to Cafe Nero. I would get up at 7 every morning. I would shave. I would, it sounds so to the point, but I would have a pint of water. I would walk to the coffee shop with my books, and I would study from about 8:30 to 5:00 every day. So it was what I was planning myself was a life in an office. So I was programming my mind, this is the way your life's going to be. And I really enjoyed the studying. The days were flying by, my weeks were filled. I stopped having these, no crazy thoughts, but you know, cloudy thoughts, I would put it that way. And I just really, really enjoyed it. And then when I passed my first year, I thought, this is great, I'm really enjoying it. And then I went back to Norway after year one, studying in the UK. And then within 6 months, I applied for a job that, you had to be bilingual, you had to have an engineering degree, and I had none of it. And I went for an interview, and for some reason, a man saw something in me, and they gave me a job, which needed 4 years education, which I didn't have. So I was fortunate, I guess. It was a really enjoyable time for me. I love learning. For me, when you're learning, when you're reading, it does something to me that I really enjoy.
This is certainly interesting, and this certainly demonstrates the flexibility in your skill set. I'm sure the listeners will be fascinated by your association with Scandinavia. I know I certainly was. It's fair to say it displays a certain courage when people move abroad to embrace a new culture as a professional. What enticed you back to living in Norway?
Well, my partner was there. So when we came back from China, I wanted to give it one last go, even though I knew my body was done. And so basically, when the Livingston thing stopped, my partner went back to work, take care of the house, etc. And then I said, you know what, I'm going to take this year here. I need to do this. I didn't want any because I had like a tutor that I can go and see, etc. So it was basically, I was distancing myself from my partner, but I knew it was right for moving forward. And I think you've got to sometimes take these tough decisions. If it's right for the long run, sometimes you've got to do it. And it's the footballer's life. It's the coach's life. You need to sacrifice something in your life. And typically it's family. Ideally, you can have your family there. But if you're from Dundee and you get the Liverpool job, you're away. But the level I'm at the moment, the money, etc., at these clubs is not enough to bring the whole family. So you're always balancing these things. And these are things that the average fan doesn't really consider. And the average fan will also say, yeah, but I would do anything to have your position. Yeah, of course you would. It's a great job. I think it makes you headstrong. I think you need to be headstrong to do it. But you also, that then makes you more thick-skinned. That's probably a better way of putting it, by doing so.
Well, staying with Norway, your first managerial job was with Sola FK, a team located just outside of Stavanger in Norway, southern Norway. How did that job come about for you? You mentioned, of course, earlier on that it was the local team to you. Did you have an existing relationship with the CEO back then?
I was with a friend who had a relationship to that club, and he says, look, come and speak to this guy. I went and spoke to him. After about half an hour, I thought, yeah, that's me. I'm going to go and have a bit of bash. And I loved it. And I took the job, took a three-year deal, paid very, it was £15,000 I was paid for it, peanuts. And I was working alongside that in Baker Hughes. So when my boss was new, looking over my shoulder, I was planning training sessions. I was couldn't wait to 8:30 to get to my, you know, my real work, which was my football. And I made a conscious decision. I said, year one, I looked at the players I got and I signed players, etc. Gave them boots instead of salary, and it was that kind of environment. And the team were training twice a week before I took over. And I said to people when I brought them in, it's 4 days a week plus the game. And if you don't want to do it, fine, no problems. I will find people that will. And everybody bought into it. I said, because if you're looking at all the successful teams, so what I was doing is, if I compared it to Rangers or Liverpool, they go, yeah, but they're paid to do that. They're full time to do that. So what I was saying was, I'm going to give you, within reason, the same timetable as a professional football club. So I was selling it to them that way. You know, I'm going to be, you're going to be training at the same time, the same intensity, and selling it to them. And again, that's that skill. You hear Pep Guardiola talking about it all the time. He sells them tactics every week. They need to believe it. They need to believe in what they're doing. And if you believe in something, it's easier to then execute it. And yeah, it was a really enjoyable time. And, you know, we got double promotion. Teams around us were paying boys £2,000 a month, £2,000 a month. We said, no, everything we're going to be good at is for free. Everything for free. And you know what? Boys were leaving that place to come to us because the environment was so good. The facilities were good. The coaching was good. That's not me, just on myself and my coaching staff. And then in the third year, we were tipped. When we got to the second division, we were tipped for relegation by every national newspaper because then you're national then, so you're flying to games, etc. And we were tipped for relegation and we finished fifth. And in that year, when we finished fifth, we knocked out a Premier League team at the Cup, beat them 1-0, you know, paying people nothing. There's guys in that Premier League on £100,000 a year playing against my wee local team. And we, so it was a special, special journey. And it's one that if I hadn't done, I wouldn't be as close to being the coach or the individual that I am now, I think.
I mean, you spent 2 years at Solihull FK, and it's first time managerial gigs go. How much of an eye-opener was the fact that you had to convince people to train 4 days a week, you had to convince them to play for a bit less, to sell them the journey of you can make it if you work really, really hard? In terms of setting standards, was it a hard thing to do?
It was 3 years I was at Solihull. Setting standards, no, because for day one, I made it crystal clear. Crystal clear. Everything that we're going to be, so my mantra was, we're going to be as good. Everything that's for free, we're going to be the best at. Everybody can turn up on time. Everybody can be late, but don't make habit of it. And I tried to make the dressing room run itself. And you know what? They were as good as gold. They were, because they were getting proper coaching. So when I was coaching them, I was saying, listen, this is me. I'm just the loudspeaker. But I'm actually telling you what Glenn Hoddle's taught me, what Dick Advocaat's taught me, what Walter Smith has taught me. That's... No, I've had five international managers. So I'm saying, look, you've got front row seats with all these people. I'm just giving you a concentrated version of what I've been taught. So then they're not looking at you, the Scottish guy. They're thinking, oh, Glenn Hoddle, I, England, I. So because they love English football over there. They're massive on it. So it was, again, it was just a whole, it was just a nice environment. And if you look at the boy, Graham Potter, he'll be saying similar stories when he was in Östersund. Fantastic journey that he's had, and look at him, he's in the Premier League. But he went through that because he knew it was right. The environment, he created an environment that was conducive to playing risky football with quality because he gave them trust. He provided an environment that they can express themselves. And you look at the way his team's playing now, phenomenal, phenomenal. So listen, I'm not saying I'm a Graham Potter. I'm saying I can recognise the journey that he's been on. It's a similar journey that I've been on, and hopefully I can emulate half of what he's done.
In terms of credentials, you touched on it. Achieving back-to-back promotions in 3 years at the club, then finishing fifth. It's no mean feat. How would you reflect upon your time there, and why did you end up leaving Solihull FK?
As lovely as it was, I was getting to the stage where your main players are 3 years older. My voice is the same voice all the time. I wanted to move to a better club. When I say better club, I mean a club with more financial clout, because I wanted to go to the next level again. And in the meantime, I had some discussions with the Premier League club in the area about joining them. That fell through. And, you know, what I would say, what I took most from it is, year one, I said to myself, I'm going to play 4-3-3. Year two, no matter what, I'm playing 4-2-3-1. Now, they're very, very similar, right? But there's slight differences in terms of how you rotate your midfield and the certain runs from the number 10 and or is it the ball side 8 that's running beyond it instead of the 10. You know, when Ozo played at Real Madrid, when I played 4-2-3-1, I said, this is Ozo's run. Because I would obviously, a geek and a nerd on football, So instead of me saying, like, the 10 must run the channel here when the fullback's got it or the ball side 6 has it. So I'm saying, that's Ozo's runs for Real Madrid. He used to make this run all the time. So when they're making that run, they're thinking, Ozo does this. So again, it's about selling that story and identifying that certain players make these runs. And of course they're going to want to do that. So when they made that run, it's like Ozo. And, you know, you're playing the game with them a wee bit. But it's management. You're playing the game half the time.
Your next role was moving slightly north to Egersunds IK. I hope I've not totally butchered the name there. How did this move come about?
I actually quit that job at Solihull. They offered me a new deal. And incidentally, they hired a Premier League manager, who the guy that we beat 1-0. So he was in the Premier League. He then took the job. And again, when the culture's not right, when the environment's not right, he got relegated the following year. So there's a guy that was on 150 grand a year versus my 15 grand a year. The culture changed. It became a running club. They were running around the track, doing 3,000 metre runs. And when do you run 3,000 metres at the same tempo, running a pitch? It's, you know, it's archaic. So it just goes to show you that if you get your environment right and you've got to make the players know they care about them. And people don't want to run on a track 3,000 metres when they've just had an 8-hour shift in an engineering factory. Or, you know what I mean? So, yeah, it was different. But to go back to your question, Egersunds, they had a better financial setup in terms of I can attract better players. And, yeah, I wanted to be bashing that. I wanted to take them up the way I did with Solihull. And it was a small village, 15,000 people. And it was very parochial. It was very, you know, these scenes where in the Westerns when a stranger walks in the bar and the music stops and everybody turns around and looks at them. It was like that. And I knew the day I walked in, I went, oh, I've made a mistake. I knew it. And I signed a 2-year deal. And I, after the first year, we finished third, which was a good result considering. Because half the top seven were getting promoted to the new setup, so it was effectively like a promotion as such, but by finishing third. And I knew straight away and I quit after the first year. But when I quit, Baker Hughes was the downturn in the oil industry, and because I was last in, I was first out. So after quitting a 40 grand a year job with the football plus my salary from Baker Hughes, I then had no salary. So it was like, oof. But again, you go back into your reserves, you say, right, what do? You go and do what you can. You're good at coaching. What's next? I got a phone call, you fancy the Faroe Islands? I went, oof, Faroe Islands, oof. And I went, you know what? Let's go. It's another year of boot camp that I'm going to dedicate myself to the sport. And that was that. I went to the Faroe Islands and did it all over again. And I really enjoyed it, actually.
That was my next question, actually, in terms of hopping across the North Atlantic. Do you think that was a subconscious decision to increase your profile in the Scandinavian region? with the prospect of becoming a very seasoned manager in that kind of area of Europe, because that's a it's an uncharted territory for a lot of people in the UK to try and make a career of it. Was that the same for you?
What it was, my logic for doing it, my rationale was that obviously Denmark used to own the Faroe Islands, so that there's a very much a connection there. So Faroese people have the option to play for Denmark, etc. So I thought, if I go do there, there's a, I mean, three clubs play in Europe from that league. So in my head, I'm going from third level Norway into potentially being a new Europa League and Champions League qualifiers. So I'm thinking, as much as the Faroe Islands, it's still an uplift in terms of football. And that was it. And they made me feel very welcome. I was in a village with 700 people when I got on the island. No, there's 18 islands in the Faroe Islands. And of course, 17 of them were connected on the mainland by tunnel or by bridge. And my island was 60 miles south on a two-hour boat journey in the North Atlantic. So you can imagine what it was like. And I got there and I was like, oh no. There's one restaurant, there's two shops, there's one pizza shop. I'm thinking, oh no, I've made a boo-boo here. But you know what? After about 3 weeks, you get to know people. And it was brilliant. These boys would do anything you told them. They adopt. And again, moving on, I played 3-5-2. I said, I'm going to go and learn 3-5-2, stroke 3-4-3. So I knew the intricacies of another formation. And that was my way of saying, this is your boot camp, this is your learning. No distractions, you, your players, your computer. And it was just, it became easy for me, actually, in a sense of mentality. I knew what I was doing was right for me, education-wise.
Your first job in the Faroe Islands was in the island of Suðuroy, managing TB Suðuroy Róin. I hope I've not mispronounced that. The population of the island is just over 4,000. Mm. And I would say, what enticed you to coach the side? But you've already answered that question in the sense that you are keen to increase your profile. And I wanted to ask as well, to what extent is the island focused on its football team? How obsessed are they? And is it the pride and joy of the island?
Honestly, you wouldn't believe it. Neurotic. I mean, again, that team was tipped to be relegated. And we ended up surpassing the club's points record. So, you know, I like to be that underdog. I say, okay, underdog, all right. And I started coaching them and putting them into shape. We used to do shape every day. Every day they came to training, there was shape. So the thing in the football world, they call it sake. So I would set up mannequins based on the opponent we were playing at the weekend. And my big thing at the time was, I wanted to smother our opponents and contain them. And it's something that I adhere to today in my day-to-day coaching. So I would just blow a whistle. So it was sprints. So if you see Bielsa's training, everything's a sprint in Bielsa's training. Now, they're no long sprints. They're like 8 to 10 yard sprints. Bang, bang, bang. And I was doing these things, but they were getting, obviously, rest in between each sprint, but they were sprinting as a unit. So the mannequins from their starting position central. So that was our default position. We get back to here. If the ball goes there, bang, we're on. And so everything was equidistant. And I was doing that 3 times a week. Just bang. By the way, it's only a 10-minute run. And of that 10 minutes, you're only sprinting maybe 2 minutes of it. But it's only a 10-yard sprint. And then I would make them see, pause. So for instance, if I put a mannequin, I put a ball at the side of a mannequin. So say the mannequin was a left back for the opponent. So we would all press that. So if the ball was on the outside, like the left back was going to clip it up the line, my players had to recognise how they pressed that ball there. Versus if the ball was on the inside of them, as if he was going back to the goalkeeper, there would be a different thought there because the ball was in a different position. So I was constantly toying with her, how they perceive and what, because running at a man is something, but where's the ball? Where's his body shape? These are all the things that I was trying to teach these boys for a fishing village in the Faroe Islands. But I wasn't doing it for them. I was doing it for me. What works? What doesn't work? Cross it off. what works, store it. And yeah, again, just enjoyed, really enjoying learning 3-5-2, 3-4-3 and what works against the 4-2-3 one. What formation do you struggle against? Is that a diamond you can struggle against? And it's all just database and trial and error. But it's then about recognising what works and what made it work against what formation. Was it because we were a better team? Okay, they kind of paid too much attention to it. Was it a better team and it worked? Now we're talking, now we can keep that, because sometimes people try to make football an absolute certainty. But you've got to look at not just the technical, the physical, the tactical superiorities. So there's so many different facets that when I'm looking at a football game, I'm going, oh, he's a top player. He's going to be better than my left back. I need numerical advantage there. So it's about understanding all these wee intricacies that I really enjoy and I'm fascinated by it.
You mentioned in this interview the impact that on the Norwegian boys that you have played under 5 international managers, Hoddle, Advocaat, etc., etc. What kind of impact did it have when you relayed that to the Faroese boys? Did they have the same knowledge of the Scottish game or the English game at all? Was it the same?
It was mainly the English game. So it was, in Scandinavia, it's Tottenham's got a massive following. Aye, you wouldn't believe that, Tottenham. Liverpool, obviously Manchester United. So they were the three, Man United, Liverpool, and Tottenham were the three main ones that they, you know, if the Man United game, Tottenham game was on, the whole village was shut down. But they just love their football and they bought into everything they've done. Just a great race of people, really great.
I'm sure the first thing certainly Scottish folk think of when they think of the Faroes is 2002 and remoteness. Mm. What were your living arrangements like? And how much did you feel like your comfort zone? You mentioned, of course, it was a very remote town with a pizza shop and two shops. What was it like?
I took a well-known figure, Mark de Vries, who used to play for Dundee United, Hearts, Leicester, over as my number two. And Mark, lovely, lovely man, decent coach, good heart, away from his family, and he couldn't hack it. He lasted about 6 weeks. And when Mark left, I was obviously sad, but, and I'm not talking ill of Mark here, I'm really not, because I love the guy. But I just thought, I've got a mental toughness here that is make, I need to go through this. And that's that mental toughness that I think you need to be at the top level, because you will have speed bumps, you will have scenarios that you're not comfortable with, but I actually enjoy them. But my living arrangement was great. I had a 4-bedroom house overlooking the fjord. Amazing. Beautiful. I mean, if you went there, if you ever get a chance to go to the Faroe Islands, spend 2 or 3 days there. By the way, take plenty of money because it's a fortune up there. No, it was a great experience. Again, floodlit state, brand new stadium. I mean, you say stadium, it was like, it can hold maybe 800 people, but it was brand new. Facilities were great, balls were perfect. Indeed, the good kit, floodlit, magic.
Well, you should be on the Faroese tourist board, Maurice, because you love the Faroes so much you bought the company. Your next job was in the Faroe Islands as well, at Víkingur. Mm-hmm. How did you discover about their interest, and what again enticed you to that role?
Their captain, who was a national team captain, when we played against him, because he played for Ross County.
So, who was that?
Atle Gregerson. Hmm. Very good footballer. Oh, what a great footballer he was. Just couldn't move, you know, he was 6'4", but just a great footballer. Oh, what a talent he was. And there was always this wee connection we had, I thought. And it became about, and they offered me the job. Obviously, they were champions that year. And I took that job. But what I didn't know was 6 of the starting lineup quit because of age. And I was only getting to replace 2. 2 into 6 doesn't go. There's going to be an issue at some stage. And again, very similar to when I went to Egerson's, I knew for day one I've made a mistake there. I knew it. I mean, I went to the chairman with a blueprint of how the club should start to operate. I said, you've been bringing in 4 or 5 foreigners from all over the place, which means you need to get them accommodation. you need to pay them $3,000 a month. You need to get them a car. I said, right now, we should go and find the 17-year-olds, the best 17, 18-year-olds in the country, and overpay them. Get them double what they're earning and start building your club. Basically, not the ground up, but these are your next group of players that are going to be the next national team players. And there was a boy that was 20. He was an under 21. So I said, he is a star. I'm telling you, one of the big clubs will take him. And because he was from a village 7 kilometres away, the chairman went bananas at me. I'm not signing players for there. We've signed players for this village. I said, for this village? I said, there's 800 people here. Of that, half of them are women. And of the half that are men, a third of them are below 10-year-old, and a third of them are 50 and above. I said, you'll give me a pool of about 50 people that I can choose for here. Oh, I knew straight away, no. But again, it's a learning curve because it's not about managing down. Half the battle is managing up. It's about understanding that people might not have the same values as you, but then trying to have a common understanding. And where I think that discussion needs to come is the day before you sign for that football club as a coach. That's the day where you need to realise that you need to interview. Sorry, on you go. I think it's just as important for me, the manager or the coach, to interview the club as much as they're interviewing me. Because I know what I stand for. They still don't know what I stand for yet. So I've got to interview them in the sense that no interview them, but I've got to know am I the right fit for them? Because see, in 6 weeks' time, it's going to come to a head anyway. So I think that's my approach now. I'm actually looking at them. Are you the right environment for me to flourish in? Because if I flourish, your team will be better. And that's not me sounding conceited or arrogant there, I hope. But when I've been in good environments, they've allowed me to perform with good environment, good facilities, be good at what's free. And I'm not asking to go on fancy holidays and stay in big hotels. Nah, that's not what I'm talking about. It's environment where the players feel happy and where they're willing to run that extra yard. They're willing to listen when you're coaching them. So, yeah, that's really important for me moving forward into my new environment.
Can I take it from the specific point of Vikingur to the broader sense of just living in the Faroe Islands and the challenges you need to overcome as a manager in these small countries? I mean, I'm sure the listeners are wondering as well, especially ones who are even vaguely familiar with the geography of the country. You mentioned there's 18 islands in the country. As for the Faroese teams, they're all spread across several of them. How did you typically travel to away games and what are the normal logistical arrangements and would that impact upon match day preparation, Mo?
Just a bus. Simple. Same as any meet a hotel, eat, go. But before I was in the Faroes, they weren't eating 3.5 hours before. They were eating like an hour before the game. I was like, what's going on? I said, you're eating beef on a match day? No. Stop. Meet 3.5 hours before. You're eating pasta. Limit the sauce. But you know what? You don't know what you don't know. So if that's all they've known, then you've got to respect that's all they've known. It's my duty to. And again, I love educating. I love the sound of my own voice. So, it's not just about. And by the way, sometimes I'm dealing with 17-year-old boys that I'm trying to talk about life skills, behaviour, being punctual, talking to them like I was an employer of a fish factory. You can't be late. You can't be coming in scruffy. You've got to be coming in presentable and ready to do your job. So it's not just about coaching tactics. It's about bringing them into your world and you're part of their world as well. I love it.
What are the key mentality differences between Norway and the Faroes and the UK?
Norwegians don't need a way out of poverty. I'm being extreme here. 85% of Norway is, you know, they've got that mushroom socialist state where they've got 85% is middle class, and you've got the 10% that's lower class, and you've got 5% that's the top oil tycoons. And I think British young footballers, because we're a working class society, we're maybe edging in more into middle class a wee bit now. I think football's a way out of the schemes, etc. I'm from that. I'm not decrying it at all. I love my upbringing, and it's made me the guy I am. So I think that's a big difference. Norwegians play football because they enjoy football. Of course, we love football here in the UK. But if they don't make it, their mum and dad have still got a cabin in the south, a cabin in the mountains. You know, so it's no as... And there's a big, big focus on education over there. So like when I was in Norway, I never knew one person that never had either a degree in carpentry or economic degree. Everybody had a degree. Whereas I think in the UK, when you're good at football, everything gets parked. But listen, you get great people and everywhere you go, you get less, guys that are maybe not as nice. So it's no matter where you go, no matter what level you're at the end of the day, you're coaching people. You're dealing with human beings, with emotions, with family problems, with learning disability, or you're learning people learn. I mean, this is something I'm massive on. You've got to have a mental map of how each individual learns. There's so many players that cannot pick up audio in isolation to learn. People need to be shown visuals. They need to live the moment with the kinesthetic. You know, people sometimes need to read and write to learn. So it's about me as a coach covering all these four learning and understanding who's who. So if I'm on a pitch coaching 22 people, 8 switch off. I'm saying 8 is a random number, but I don't learn audio gaffer. Okay. And people, you know, you hear coaches saying it all the time. You know, listen to me. I told you a minute ago. Well, I didn't learn audio. They're not going to say that because they're not thinking it. They're not aware of how they learn. It's about me as a coach understanding how they learn. But he's not picking this up. So now I need to alter my approach on him. So I don't address him on a pitch full of 20 players. I need to bring him into the office. I need to show him on the board. I need to show him a video. I need to show him, walk him around the football pitch, but maybe when people are not there. Then if he doesn't pick it up and I've showed him all these four things, then in the long run, he'll not be at the club. Because if you can't learn, I'm wasted as a coach. Because I'm there to educate. If you can't pick up what I'm saying, when I've covered all the four bases of learning, then I'm now not good enough. But I'm going to be the manager, so I need to now get rid of you and bring somebody else that can learn. So that's kind of how I look at it.
That's a truly fascinating insight into modern coaching. And touching on that, historically, generations of young footballers have been conditioned into playing a rigid 4-4-2, whereas now we've seen Scotland, for example, revert to a slightly more fluid version of 4-5-1 under Steve Clarke. How would you respond to the claim that we're too tactically inflexible in Britain compared to other countries?
I think it's a bit of a general statement. I think it's a sweeping statement. I know it's not your statement. I don't think that's necessarily correct. I think nowadays there's more need for it. I think players expect it now. I think there's many coaches pointing the finger at players. Ah, but you can't overcomplicate it. You can't teach them. They don't take it in. For me, that's a coaching failure. Too many lazy coaches out there that don't want to make themselves better. If you don't want to make yourself better, if you've not got that care to be better in yourself, what's the likelihood you're going to want to make somebody else better? No. You've got to want to be the best you can be. And that natural curiosity of, I want to understand that. I want to be better at that. That then transports into your players because that's your way of doing it. And I hear it all the time. But when I was when I came back from the Faroe Islands, I was out of work for 7 months, and I travelled up and down Scotland, and all I heard was, you can't tell them too much, but they just don't get it. I think we've all been to school, we've all went through the best part of 13 years education, and if teachers in the classroom had that approach, we'd all be struggling, wouldn't we? And I think we've got to fight against that.
To what extent then were you maybe concerned, for want of a better expression, about the visibility of your success in Scandinavia for those in mainland Europe or the UK?
Well, when I came back and I was, you know, went to Motherwell and I had my interview there, and I spoke to a few clubs prior to going into Motherwell, weren't interested. I heard all the usual statements. Ah, but yeah, I need somebody that knows the championship in Scotland. I'm actually glad I don't know the championship in Scotland, because I've been under five international managers that have not been associated with Championship Scotland. I've been abroad, learning different cultures, learning different styles. That's why I've not been at Championship in Scotland. You know, and it was that whole, you hear it all the time in football, yeah, we just need somebody that knows League One. Well, either you're playing a different sport or what? I think there's too many generalisations, too many generic, nothing throwaway statements that I hear all the time, and you can see that the top level now, it's intellectuals that are taking over. It's German intellectuals that are probably read a book a week, two books a week on top of doing their coaching, etc. And it's you see the results. Look at the boy Thomas Tuchel, different level. Pep, different level. They speak multi. They're polywots. They speak multiple languages. And that's what I aspire to be. So it's but again, it's a process that I'm learning every day. I'm keen on being better every day, and it's just a matter of time before I get back in.
Listening to you, I can corroborate that view. Your assistant while working in the Faroes, you mentioned, was Mark De Vries, ex Leicester City, ex Hearts, and Dundee United. How did that relationship come about? Did you meet at a coaching course, and then you?
Yeah, Mark was on my A licence in 2017, and he was very. He used to come up and quiz me all the time. What did that mean, and what was that, and what made you think that? And I thought, he's got enough humility. That top player is coming to me asking me, so he's curious. He's enough humility to come and ask a question and in front of peers. I mean, I like him, and he's a profile as well. And I thought, there's another profile that we're more of a package. You know, he can then open up Ben, you know, Holland, etc. And it was we had a good connection as people. It was also strategic as well that two profiles. He had a bigger profile than me, arguably. It was better than me and just a wee guy that would just do everything you told him. So he would quiz me all the time, and I liked that. I enjoyed that.
On reflection, what were the key challenges during your time in the Faroes, and how did you overcome them?
Key challenges? The wind. I remember I set up a training, and I'm neurotic with my cones, so my cones need to be in line, exact. I'm terrible for it. And I set my session up, and I knew it was a wee bit windy. I thought, will they hold that? They'll be fine. I went back in. I came back out. And all the cones were, and that side of the pitch were now the sea that the sort of came down the valley and out to sea. I was like, I can't believe that. But the goal was also on the halfway line, so that had moved. So you can imagine how windy this was. So, that was difficult. The weather, the boat was an issue. I remember I was always forgetting the time of the boat. Sometimes it would change slightly, and I woke up in a panic one day, and I've looked out my window, and the boat is going to play the Champions, by the way, and I'm the manager. I've missed the boat. Now there's no other boat, right? So you know that way when you get out of bed, like when you're late for a plane or whatever, you think, oh no, and you're ready instantly, one of the ones, right? So I'm panicking, oh no, we're meeting the Champions, they're going to sign me next year, the manager's not turned up, they're going to think, oh, this guy's, you know, unprofessional and whatnot. So I'm phoning. Now remember, these are 7 meter waves going over across this crossing, right? It's mental. So I'm like, just get me a boat to my chairman. Listen, there's nothing on. But one of the players' dads was in charge of kind of like the Coast Guard and stuff like that. And so if there's any fatalities or any mountain injuries in the Faroes, it's the helicopter that goes. Just so happens there was nothing planned that day. And they then practice. So they've sent me a helicopter so I'm standing there panicking, with my gear ready to go, my tactics board and everything. And I can just hear in the background this, helicopter just comes over the mountain. So the boys have left on this boat for 2.5 hours to the thingy, and I was in the restaurant sitting there waiting. I was like, just get the boat, lads. I just got a helicopter, right? it was a good time. There was no difficulties. It was just nothing any different if you were coaching in England or in Scotland. It was obviously, apart from the travel.
Well, you arrived back to your home country of Scotland after leaving the Faroes. Was it always your plan to return to Scotland, or did you indirectly want to go back via a few countries to work as a manager there?
No, I wasn't desperate to come to Scotland. It was the natural place to come when I left the Faroes. I was open to going to Denmark. I was open to going to Norway at a better level. And obviously I ended up at Motherwell. And at the time, Motherwell needed a 23s coach. So I headed up the 23s and down. After about 6 months of that, the manager took me straight into the first team, and then we re-employed. I was straight into the first team setup, which I do prefer. If I was going to be into the 23s level, it would need to be, if it was in England, it would need to be at quite a high level for me to get enough meat on the bone for me. I don't mind going to the lower leagues as such for a more prominent position. But I think when you're dealing with kids that the way I want to coach, I think it lends itself to more Premier League and Championship level in terms of the understanding and how I want to do it. So, yeah, no, I never planned on it, but I'm certainly looking at the English market now. I'm looking at opportunities now as an agent. So, yeah, I'm so relaxed about it. I'm so relaxed being out of work because can feel something's coming. I really do.
Well, of course, when you did come back to Scotland, it was in November 2019, we joined the coaching staff at Motherwell. I mean, that was initially, was that 23s or the 20s that you're heading up?
It was end of January I joined 2019, and then it was 6 months of heading up the reserves, 23s and the 18s, and it was just about marrying them together. So when I went in there, I went, okay, it's my job to make 16-year-olds that are at the 16s, let's get the 16s into the 18s. Because the 18s, half of them are not going to play football in a year's time. So give me the best 16s. Let's move everybody up the trough. And what my job then was, as a manager likes 4-3-3, it's my job to take the 16s to make them into 18s players, the 18s into 23s, and the best 23s within 6 months, I want them trimming the first team. So it's my job is, When the best of the 23s go into the manager's first team, my job then, if I've done the job right, is they players, the gaffer doesn't need to spend time educating them because I've already done it for them. So it was putting a ribbon through the whole thing. And again, 6 months in, four of them been through the 23s, training the first team every day, new contracts. That's where I think, yes, this is great. I love this. Seeing young boys moving on, making their debut at the end of the season, that's where my, again, but that comes from the same players, same age, not any stronger, tweaking their thought processes. That's where I'm massive on, your thought process. How you think of wearing the football pitch determines whether you're a good player or a great player.
You place emphasis on educating tactical awareness, spatial awareness, and how games can be won by players having very strong positional discipline. How impressed were you by the young players when you first got in at Motherwell?
I was impressed by how willing they were to open their minds to me as such. And their hunger for football and how quick they cottoned on to it. Now, I'm not saying I'm reinventing the wheel here, right? But there's a certain way 4-3-3 should be played, in my opinion. Because when I watch Man City doing it and I watch the other top teams in the world doing it, there's certain habits that a certain position must have. There's certain movements at certain times that players must recognise. So it was about... It wasn't scrapping, but it was just tweaking how they should think about football. Because the execution is on them, but it's my job to put them into positions, the body shape and understanding in relation to their teammates and opponents and the goal and the ball, four reference points, how they influence a football match. Whether they take a good touch or a bad touch, that's on them. It's on the pitch sometimes. My job is to educate them 3 seconds before that ball comes to them. Where are you receiving it? The amount of players that run towards the football when you're in possession beggars belief for me. For me, you should run towards a football when you've no got the ball. Running towards the ball, for me, sometimes you need a relief pass, right, if you're under pressure. I get that. So if it's a striker's pressing a right centre-back and he's running towards him, then he might just need a pass, you know, just he needs to bounce it to go to the other centre-back from a six, right? But in general, I think if there's no ball pressure, players should move away from the ball. So I constantly reinforce that. If players are running towards it, now you can angle towards it, but you can angle away from it. But you shouldn't be running at full speed towards the football if you're in possession and you see it everywhere. And then you hear the coach shouting. So a striker, a number nine, so a fullback's got it, say halfway in his half. A striker is at the semicircle. Centre circle, sorry, and he runs to angle for the centre, the fullback to play him 2 feet. If he's got a man behind him, he's running towards a ball that's running, moving towards him, and the manager shouts, "Keep the ball!" I'm like, there's too much energy there. It's so difficult to control a football while moving towards a football. And I use this analogy all the time. See if a cricket fielder catches a ball, what's the first thing he does? He goes in the same direction as the ball. He doesn't go towards the ball. Because if he goes towards it, there's an impact there. It's very difficult to control. But they take the energy of the ball. It's the same in football. There's hundreds of analogies I can use, but just for the ease of kind of understanding it. Do you get what I'm saying with that?
Yeah.
It's the same. So if you're the hardest thing in football, the main aim in football for me is to get turned and play forward. So I'm putting players in positions to highlight and to give them the best chance of success to get half-turn and play forward. And running towards the ball is not one of them, in my humble opinion.
Well, before we do touch on your time with Motherwell's first team, we have a question from a listener called Mark Connor, age 28, from Glasgow. Is there a specific coach or manager from your time at Rangers that you draw inspiration from in how you coach now and implement your ideas?
Yeah, undoubtedly. I did an article on the Athletic about a month ago with Jan Wouters, Dutch coach, and one of the guy, Jordan Campbell, who's a brilliant writer in the Athletic, asked him who his influences were, and it was Johan Cruyff and Frans Beckenbauer. And I just thought, wow. So like I was saying to the solo players, you've got front row seats with Dick Advocaat, Glenn Hoddle. Jan Wouters gave me front row seats with Johan Cruyff and Frans Beckenbauer because of his their principles. And I'm not saying I'm on that level at all. Please understand that. But the tenets of what makes the players good players, the foundations, the thought processes. Because at professional football, everybody's got a good touch. Okay, not everybody, but majority. It's the thoughts and how they move and how they think. Of course, physicality comes into it. You know, all the top players are quick. Majority are very quick athletes. But I believe it's the thoughts that make you what you are.
Very interesting. We've got another question from Drew Naughton from Garrow Hill. Do you think there's such a thing as an overcoached player? Is this idea linked to the death of the old school chalk in the boots winger in the modern era?
Okay, chalk in the boots. This is actually a good question. An overcoached player? No. Can you have an over-educated man? No, you cannot. Can you? You can't tell me somebody's over-educated because there's always something you can learn. You can pick up, you can go and learn Chinese tomorrow. It's another thing you've learned. You know what I mean? So here's the thing. Chalk on the boots winger. Chalk on the boots winger, see he's wide right. The six, the holding midfielder turns from the left side of the pitch, gets it from the left winger, and he pings a switch to the right winger who's got his boots on the chalk, right? What if he takes a bad touch? That ball's out the pitch. So if he comes in 3-4 yards and he takes a bad touch, he's got a chance of recovering that because of that 3-4 yard, 5 yard space he's given himself. If you receive the ball on the touchline, you've got one less dimension to play in. You can only play in the pitch. But if you stand 5 yards in, you can still shape something down the line. So you can play outside the pitch. So you can actually shape it down the line. So by playing wide, you can only play inside. By playing inside, you can play inside and outside. So again, that's only something there. It's got nothing to do with technique. It's about where to stand and where to position yourself to give you the best chance of success. That's a coaching point.
Interesting again. Finally, one from Lewis Gow in Elephant and Castle in London.
Well, I've been there.
it's a nice place. What style of coaching appealed to you as a player, and has this changed now you're a coach?
It's not for everyone, but when I was at school, I used to always ask why. All my mum used to get at parents' evening was, "Oh, this is hard work. Ask why. He needs to know why everything." I said, "But yeah, but that's how he learns." So for me, I used to love when Jan Bouters used to coach and give me detail why. These small things that make me better. So for me now as a coach, I don't enjoy possession for doing possession's sake. 10 guys, 10v10 in a big square running around mental with no reference points other than their opponent and teammate. There's no direction to it. The distances are too small or too big. It's just a time filler. So I think everything needs to be with a direction, with a purpose, and with constant realism to do a passing drill in isolation. There's no relevance to it for me. There's no opponent, there's no mannequin, they're okay for technique and just warming up, etc. But I think when you go to Liverpool can have these things because they're all brilliant footballers. They've got football understanding, but for us at Motherwell, we need to be coaching positional sense every day. I hear these 8-week periodization things getting talked about, right? They're okay from a physical point of view, in my opinion. But I'm telling you now, if I spoke to a player at Motherwell, I'm choosing Motherwell because they're my latest club, and I spoke about something on a Monday at week one, if I never told him till another 8 weeks' time about that, he forgets that by next Wednesday. The amount of times we used to work on throw-ins, say, yes, we've got the throw-ins clicking. Now, we work on throw-ins all the time. You think about it, the ball's in play for 60 minutes in the 90 minutes on average. So it's either goal kicks, corners, free kicks or throw-ins. So it's just one facet of the game that we focus on. But if we stopped, so if we never did it that week, the following week and the Saturday, the throw-ins would be poor because players switch off. So I think an 8-day cycle is more realistic versus an 8-week cycle if you're talking about tactical.
It's all about marginal gains, really, ultimately, isn't it? Well, Stephen Robinson, the first team manager, promoted you to first team coach in February 2019. How strong was your relationship with Stephen?
Very strong. It's very easy to be as a manager to flex your muscles as a manager. The amount of times he would ask my opinion, the amount of times he would let me take, the meaty stuff in the training, which was the stuff that makes a difference on a Saturday. He did that often with me. He trusted me. And I wanted to repay him every day. So when I did a session, I wanted it to be a phenomenal session because he's given me that platform. I want I want him to think, yeah, that's a brilliant session. I loved when I came off the pitch and went, that was a proper session. I loved it. And yeah, he's just a very, he's a very good manager and he's a brilliant coach. He's a hybrid. He's for any League One championship team in England, Stevie Robinson, he can do it with his eyes shut, doesn't he? But it's the merry-go-round sometimes down in England. It's all the same names. You see them, they go, they get sacked for one job, they go to the next job, and they get 10 moves on the back of half a good season. So Stephen Robson for me is the best I've seen in terms of the hybrid. Obviously, I've had Glenn Hoddle in there. He's a proper coach. I think it's quite a statement for me that Stephen is the best I've seen. And like the whole thing, running a club, harmony, can coach, can recruit, can get a tactical point over, plus keep players happy. I mean, finishing third in Scotland with a 1.5 million budget, it's alarming for me.
Yeah. Well, you helped develop talent such as David Turnbull now at Celtic, Alan Campbell still in the Motherwell first team, and James Scott who earned a move to Hull. How proud does it make you to see all three flourish, knowing that Maurice Ross has taught them something, Maurice Ross has guided them?
Listen, David Turnbull, if you dropped him in the middle of Antarctica with no coaching ever, is still a phenomenal talent. So I'm not going to be taking in much to do with that. But in terms of football understanding, and this is where I believe I come in as a coach, is football understanding. For David Turnbull to get to Everton or wherever when he leaves Celtic, he will need to brush up on his football understanding. Because why are you a better player at 20 or 31, 32 than you are at 22? Your nose quick, right? You're more injury prone. Your football understanding's better. So what I keep trying to say to coaches and players, and teach them younger, more pertinent detail. They can't understand it. They can't understand it. It's just you've got to have the balls and their belief and the understanding yourself to then relay that to the player. And I'm telling you, education liberates people all over the world. I don't see why footballers are any different. So to answer your question, yes, I know that I've had a small impact on certain players and they've done great. But it's like anyway, if I don't take an approach that understanding how they learn, if I'm not curious of how they learn, doesn't matter how good a detail I'm given, it's lost, it's on deaf ears. So it goes back to that word curiosity again. If you're curious and you want to make the difference, you can make the difference. And I think that probably the educating, curiosity and humility are probably the three things to take for this podcast.
Well, that's the thing. You did help the club to finish third last season. That's an incredible achievement with a fairly relatively minuscule budget compared to the Aberdeens and Hibs of this world. Even Hearts ended up relegated. Would that go down as one of your best achievements as coach?
Yeah. Being part of a team that sang off the same hymn sheet. There was no ego. We all worked together. Phenomenal group of players and staff. Brilliant staff that's been ripped apart since. And I'm very, very proud to have managed on a European stage. Coached on a European stage. Because obviously I played in that, but my new thing, I don't want to focus on what I played. It's about my coaching now. And yeah, it's another thing that I'm really, really proud of. But listen, I'm proud for a minute, then it's canned. Right, next thing, where are we going? I want to look forward all the time. That's how I would explain it best.
How disappointed were you to exit the European stages this season when you did?
When you're playing against, what was it, the Tel Aviv side, Beersheba, they're paying boys 10, 20 grand a week. You can't compete. End of the day, you hear Pep Guardiola talk about it all the time. We win matches because we have the best players. But what Pep does is Pep takes unknown quantities, unknown names, and makes them into world stars. That's what makes him the best for me. he's a doctor of football for me. I love him. I think he's the best by a mile. By a mile. And he's quick to give Bielsa a bit of caramel, and he's quick to give Klopp a bit of caramel. Mourinho, for me, there's only one star on the show for me, and it's Pep.
Seems to be Morris Ross. Well, how did your departure from the club come around, and what did you learn overall from the experience? What are the key takeaways from your time at Motherwell?
My key learnings? There is no certainty in football. Behave impeccably, give your all, educate every opportunity. Sometimes a change of managers, a change of circumstance. And I am very secure in my own skin. And to remove myself from that environment because of principle and handle it in a professional manner, I'm very pleased with that. But again, when one door closes, another one will open. I'm excited for what's about to happen. And by the way, I don't know anything that's going to happen. This is me just, listen, it's a new journey for me, and it's one I'm comfortable with.
Well, finally then, what's next for Morris Ross? For any club chairman or director listening to this podcast, what would be your ideal project? Because the word project's a very, very general term now. It's used commonly throughout the industry. But what would be your ideal project, Morris?
Ideal project? Real. Again, ideal is not often realistic. Ideal is joining a Man City coaching team. It's not going to happen. But I think, again, going into an environment that was no really in a time sensitive, it's not going to be 6 weeks. I mean, Russell Martin, who's a boy that I really admire, who's on my pro license, who's now the manager at MK Dons, he was quizzed about by a journalist about, you know, need to have a plan B, and he just shot the boy down. Have you seen that interview?
I've seen it, yeah.
Fantastic. That is a man that's on the road to success, because he understands that changing something that you've not worked on, that's change for change's sake. So I think reasonable amount of time, an environment that's forward-thinking. So if it's League One, try not to think like League One. What's best in class in League One? What's the bottom of the Championship doing? Let's aspire to that. Can we do it for free? Can we educate them to a level that they overperform? It's not just about spending money all the time. It's not just about getting fancy training ground. It's about having a good surface, good balls, good coaches, and a good bunch of boys that are willing to learn. And that's what we had at Motherwell. And I think if you can replicate that at any football club, then you've got a chance.
Well, by the sounds of things, whatever the whole future does hold for you, I'm absolutely convinced you'll make a success of it. Morris, thank you very, very much for joining us here at Not The 92. It's been seriously an absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Brilliant. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.